for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. It's April the 9th, 2007. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. Got a good show lined up for you today. Justin Raimondo will be joining us on the phone in about 15 minutes, the editorial director of antiwar.com. And all the other interviews fell through, but I got a ton of news and important stuff to talk about and a call-in number for you guys to call in and get involved on the air if you want to. So hopefully we'll have a pretty good show, and I got a pretty good interview planned out for Justin. So this should be a good time. And I guess go ahead and get started with the fact that today, April 9th, 2007, is the fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. And I think it's a good time probably for us to go back and think about, I don't know, for example, what TV was saying 4 years ago today. Remember the triumph of American aggression and how wonderful it was and how all those who opposed the war were supposed to eat crow, because after all, there's Saddam Hussein's statue being pulled down in the town square. That's the, it's just like the statues of Lenin and Stalin falling at the end of the Soviet Empire, or even the Emperor at the end of the retouched Return of the Jedi and his statue falling. Isn't that wonderful? And yet, the fall of that statue, ultimately, I think, serves as a wonderful metaphor for the entire rest of that Iraq war, beginning with the sycophancy of the mainstream media in this country, who, despite all facts and evidence, are willing to turn right around and parrot whatever the government says to you still. I think that's one of the most important lessons that can be taken from the Iraq war, is just what so-called free media we have in this country and how beholden they are to the corporations that make the bombs that are used in these wars. But secondly, and if you didn't know this, then I guess this might be a shock to you, but most people, at least who are online and read Counterpunch, know, and that is that the fall of the statue was staged. It was entirely staged. That was no riot of Iraqi citizens rushing to the square to topple Saddam's statue. Those were all exiles. That was Ahmed Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress and their buddies. And they came in and they used a Marine Corps tank, tied a chain to it, and pulled it down. In fact, Saddam Hussein built pretty tough statues just for such an occasion. I think they had kind of a bit of difficulty tearing that thing down. But they have the faraway pictures, and in fact, if you go to antiwar.com today, it's the second headline from the top 4 years later. Let's see, what do they call the headline exactly there today? Is it going to let me know? No, it's not. I forgot. It's not on there. See if I can get to antiwar.com. Here it is. 4 years ago, just another staged Baghdad rally. And if you click on that, you can see the faraway shots of the fall of that statue and how there was basically nobody there. There were 20 or 30 people there. And remember back to, can you remember 4 years ago, TV and the close-up shots that made it look like there was this massive mob tearing down this statue? Do you remember? We can go and look at the, again, the second to the top headline on antiwar.com today, and it'll take you and show you the pictures that antiwar.com ran 4 years ago. I think they originally ran at Counterpunch. That showed just how sparse that crowd was. The whole thing was staged for your consumption. The Iraqis never bought it. It was for you. Just like the war that Bill Clinton, who supported it, went on David Letterman and sold the American people that it would only take 1 week after it had been almost 4 weeks of war. They had the wonderful happenstance of the capture of Jessica Lynch, which they apparently immediately hired their most fabulous screenwriters from L.A. to come and spruce up the story a little bit. The next thing you know, you have, you know, this cute little blonde who is, you know, Rambo, who fights till her gun jams, shoots till her gun jams, and then stabs three of them before they finally take her. And yeah, that whole stage thing. And again, it was strictly for your consumption. It was to basically keep you living in the realm of the government's narrative about the war, rather than, you know, observing facts and trying to make reasoned conclusions about them. They rather just keep you caught up in this story. And so that's what the TV cameras are there to do. And I remember people back in 2002... when I said, you know, we have no idea what's going on in that war over there, just what they're telling us on TV. And he said, no way, man. We got embedded reporters now. And what that means is that we'll get the whole entire unvarnished truth, because the army can't lie about anything, because the military, the media guys are right there all along. Come on. Come on. I think, you know, even that guy probably by now realizes that the purpose of embedding the media, well, first of all, the idea of embedding the media didn't come from the media. It came from the military. And the reason that they wanted to do that was to control the message. And of course, they did. They did a great job. And occasionally, they don't barely even cover the war anymore, as I've complained on this show many times. If you watch MSNBC, they show the same shot of the same building getting blown up every single day, 10 times a day. It's the same shot of the same building being blown up. They've shown for years and years. You know, like, apparently there is no new footage of Iraq, at least that NBC owns, that they can go and splice together for some new file pictures. But what we saw during the invasion, of course, was a lot of profile views of Americans shooting, right? Of American Lockheed Martin trademark weapons systems firing, but never where they landed, never the bodies. In fact, you know, there's a great article about the first Gulf War about where the hell are all the bodies? Well, where they are is the Americans bulldozed them all into a ditch. Tens of thousands of them, many of them were still alive. You know, wounded Iraqi soldiers laying on the ground there. That's why America was able to have a war, a massive war against Iraq back in 1991, and you didn't have to look at pictures of dead Iraqis. It's because they buried them all, many of them alive, but, you know, either way, they're all under sand, so you don't have to see them or smell them, which, you know, pretty far away for that anyway. But this time around, they knew they weren't just going to be able to take bulldozers like the Highway of Death and bury all the people who die. So they just embedded the soldiers, and then as soon as possible after that, the media basically all just came home and quit reporting on the war. They'll report on the politics of the war, of course. They'll report on, you know, what's happening in America as people argue about the war. And of course, they'll cover, well, a truck bomb went off here today, occasionally. But do they cover the war, really? I don't think so. I mean, the fact of the matter is, still to this day, the only place on television where you can get someone to say, well, see, among the Shiites, you have, in political factions, among the Shiites, you have the Iranian-backed Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, and then you have Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army, and then a few other minor militias from there, and these are their various interests, and, you know, this is, yeah. You can't get that kind of discussion on television at all, except perhaps on PBS, during an interview or something, but, you know, here we are 4 years into this war, and has anybody beyond the readers of antiwar.com and Juan Cole's blog and listeners to this show even know what the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq is? Does anybody in this whole country even know what that is? Have you ever even heard of it? Of course, those are the people in power. Those are the people who control Iraq now. Those are the people that the American government has installed in power. Well, who are they? They are Iraqis who went to exile in Iran after the war broke out in 1980. And lived there until 2003, when George Bush overthrew their enemy Saddam and placed them in power. They're the Iran factions. But we, you know, that kind of thing isn't even talked about on television. Here we are 4 years later, and media coverage of the war amounts to the same old statue falling down with no real context, with only illusion as context. You know, the President of the United States repeatedly on TV says, you know, we cannot fail. There is no failure. We must have victory. If we fail, it'll be a disaster. No one ever says, yeah, but that just means you already failed, right? None of the reporters ever say, you're admitting total failure. And you're saying that if you leave now, you will leave a failure, right? Nobody ever says that. Nobody ever says, we have to have victory. Would you mind precisely defining what it means that we have what it means to have victory in Iraq? Is it that the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution have total power over the Sunni Arabs and, you know, a good handshake deal with the Kurds? Is that victory? Or is victory a pro-American dictatorship of one brand or another that's going to allow us to keep bases for another 30 or 50 or 100 years in that land? What exactly is victory in Iraq when 4 years ago the statue of Saddam was pulled down by the Marines and a few exiles? The war's been over for 4 years. Remember, it was May Day, Communism Day, World Global Democratic Revolution Day, May Day, 2003, that Bush landed on the SS Abraham Lincoln and announced mission accomplished. The war is over. The Baathists are destroyed. We did it. And now here we are 4 years later, but we can't leave until we have victory? Well, by all means, fine. Let's start with defining it, okay? You define victory for me, and then we'll argue about whether that's attainable or not. Because if victory means that the Skiri, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, and their allies in the Dawah Party have total dominance over the Sunni Arabs, well, that's never going to work, and that's only going to cause a regional war as the rest of the Sunni Arab states jump in. And if victory is a peaceful handshake deal between the leaders of the Sunni factions and the Shiite factions, and a deal to split up the oil among everyone and cut in the Americans on it and let us keep bases there and this and that, I'm here to tell you it's not going to happen, and no amount of troop surge is going to make it happen either. I mean, Petraeus, if you listen to Joe Lieberman and the rest of these, you know, former left-wing radicals turned right-wing warmongers, these neocons, if you listen to the way they tell it, it's unconscionable to appoint Petraeus to be the new general in Iraq and not let him carry out his surge plan. And, of course, not let him, meaning, you know, demanding that it's over at least a year from now. Okay, but anyway, if you accept that part. But it is Petraeus himself. Did I say Petraeus? I'm sorry. General Petraeus himself, who says there is no military solution to this. This is for the State Department guys to figure out. There must be a political solution or there will be no solution. That's what the head general says. And yet, no, the surge is going to win it all. I saw Nir Rosen on PBS the other night talking with Fareed Zakaria, the guy who said that Saddam Hussein is the linchpin of our policy in the Middle East. If he didn't exist, we'd have to create him back in the 1990s. But anyway, he was interviewing Nir Rosen. And, I forgot my point. Something about how much I can't stand, or how little, I guess, I can stand Fareed Zakaria. But anyway... we're going to do an interview with Justin Raimondo right after this important commercial message. Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
too short, coming straight from Oakland.
This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Block, short dog. I'm that rapping man. I said it before, and I say it again. Life is too short. My life, you'll be fighting to live. Life is to me my main asset. I'll be doing alright and keep it just like that. Chill out at the house and bump that bass. I'm trying to get rich as I rock the place. Everybody's got that same old dream, to have big money and fancy things. Drive a brand new Benz, keep your bank right here. Never hear me stutter once, cause I talk real clear. It's on you, homeboy, what you gonna do? You can take my advice and start working, fool. Or you can close your ears and run your mouth. And one day, homeboy, you'll soon find out. Life is too short. Watch your back, life is.
Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and this is Radio Chaos 95.9, 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas. Chaos Radio. That was Justin Raimondo, editorial director of Antiwar.com. And, boy, that was the beginning of the last song already. Yeah, so I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio, and I got a ton of news here. By the way, anybody wants to get involved on the show, there's a couple of ways you can do it. Go to KAOS959.com, where you can also, by the way, stream live worldwide. And down there at the bottom of the page is a place to make requests, and you can go ahead and put in questions there if you want. Shauna wanted me to ask Justin about Goldwater's connection to the libertarian movement, but I didn't see it until we were already talking about Iran, and it was too late. But so put in any questions you want to there in the request box on the front page of Chaos Radio, KAOS959.com, or call in on the telephone. It's I am connected here. Yeah, it's 646-6446-646-6446. If you're from out of town, it's 512-646-6446, and I'm working on it. I'm going to try to get an 800 number for you guys, but Anyway, yeah, that's the number, 512-646-6446, if anybody wants to call in Anti-War Radio. And let's see, I got a ton of news to talk about here. Basically, you know, I think I just want to start with the dang times. There's so much to talk about. Just straight out of the New York Times from yesterday, or let's see, Saturday, yesterday, and today. This one's from yesterday, April 8th, 2007, by Michael R. Gordon, one of the worst reporters in America. 3 months after the United States successfully pressed the United Nations to impose strict sanctions on North Korea because of the country's nuclear test, Bush administration officials allowed Ethiopia to complete a secret arms purchase from the North in what appears to be a violation of the restrictions, according to senior American officials. The United States allowed the arms delivery to go through in January, in part because Ethiopia was in the midst of a military offensive against Islamic militias inside Somalia, a campaign that aided the American policy of combating religious extremists in the Horn of Africa. American officials say that they were still encouraging Ethiopia to wean itself from its long-standing reliance on North Korea for cheap Soviet-era military equipment to supply its armed forces, and that Ethiopian officials appeared receptive. But the arms deal is an example of the compromises that result from the clash of two foreign policy absolutes. The Bush administration's commitment to fighting Islamic radicalism, and empowering it everywhere, I guess he left unsaid there, and its effort to starve the North Korean government of money it could use to build up its nuclear weapons program. Well, anyway, we have a deal with North Korea now. But I just thought this was worth pointing out for the hypocrisy of American foreign policy, that North Korea is this axis of evil nation because they sell weapons. And yet, when they're selling weapons to Ethiopia, who are invading Somalia at America's request, and with American backing, well, then it's perfectly okay for the North Koreans to be proliferators of weapons. It's perfectly okay for them to sell weapons, as long as they're selling them to people who are warring against people we want them to war against. And in case you missed it, because, you know, I don't think Katie Couric has even mentioned it yet. Not that I watched that show, I'm just guessing, but... yeah, that's right, there's a proxy war going on in Somalia. Hundreds and hundreds, perhaps thousands of people are dying. And it's because America backed Ethiopia in an invasion at the end of December. And the fighting continues to go on there. That's right, America has decided that the bad guys from last time, remember Black Hawk Down? Those evil warlords? Well, they're the good guys now. And America is now backing the warlords against the indigenous Somalians who actually live there and who had created their own little Islamic courts union, is what it was called. And no, it was not the most progressive government in the world, but it was peace and security for the first time really in Somalia in quite a while. And America went in and destroyed it. And, you know, in fact, there's probably some poor Somali person being blown apart with high explosives as we speak because of the policy of the government of the United States of America. And the whole thing started from a simple mistake. This was all in the Washington Post. Some American special forces and CIA types landed in an airfield, and they just happened to land right near a firefight that was going on between two different groups of locals, the Islamic Courts Union versus some warlords fighting over access to a road. And the Americans, of course, being the center of the universe, assumed that the battle was all about them and that the fire was all directed at them. And they jumped on their plane and took off and reported back that, oh my God, Al-Qaeda is already there and obviously controls the whole place, or else how come they were there waiting for us when we came? Oh my God. And so that was last summer. And that was when the Islamic Courts Union, which had, you know, basically finally won and controlled Somalia, was begging the United States of America to you know, have friendly relations and be part of the West. And, you know, believe us, we got nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. We want to be y'all's friends. And the Americans decided, nope, obviously you're Al-Qaeda guys, and we can't have anything to do with you. And so then set about a policy of backing the United Nations-created government in exile in Ethiopia, which ought to be, you know, just in as defined by its own words, ought to be enough to show you how completely illegitimate this so-called government is. But then at the end of December, America backed Ethiopia's invasion and installation of this government in exile in Somalia. And now there's terrible violence going on there. And probably people who have only heard of Al-Qaeda once or twice are thinking that they would probably like to kill some Westerners and call themselves Al-Qaeda too, if they can. And, you know, I've been trying to cover this story as best I can on anti-war radio without much information, but there I got a great interview with Chris Floyd, who is just one hell of a reporter and a pretty good commentator at that. And I had him on the show just a couple of weeks ago to talk about how there's a young man born in New Jersey, an American citizen who was apparently arrested or taken captive originally by American special forces on the border between Kenya and Somalia. And, you know, of course he's guilty, or else why else would he be running? He was abducted by these Americans who told him, you know, fess up to being a member of Al-Qaeda, which he refused to do. So they turned him over to the new so-called government of Somalia, who then turned him over to the government of Kenya. And he is now rotting in a cell in, pardon me, did I say Kenya? He was turned over, by American and Kenyan authorities to, Somalia, who then turned him over to Ethiopia, where he's now rotting in an Ethiopian prison cell. He has been, extraordinarily renditioned to Ethiopia, an American citizen has. And of course, I'm sure he'll be treated, perfectly well until he goes ahead and admits that he's, an Al-Qaeda guy. And of course, then once he does, that'll justify anything that's been done to him to make him confess such things. So, that's the current, American foreign policy in Africa, playing out right before your eyes there. Imagine Africa being our business. Imagine, this massive continent, thousands of miles away from here, is somehow America's responsibility. Perhaps there's resources that need to be secured, because I'm here to tell you, the as Justin pointed out in the last interview, all those borders in Africa were drawn by the Europeans, by the Dutch and the French and the English. And those people are going to fight those problems out. That's got nothing to do with us. But no, apparently America's first or second priority now is Africa. That's right. America must control Africa. We must control the Horn of Africa. And we can't have instability. And if that means backing the former communist genocidal despot in Ethiopia, then that's okay too. You know, because we got to have that stability, you see. And so that's why America's created the new African Command. You know, since 1947, the earth has been divided up into little pieces, by the American military. But only now, only in the 21st century are they getting around to creating an African command. So, you know, look forward to your son or your grandson dying in Africa, fighting a war in Africa, maybe in 10 or 15 years from now. Because that's what it means to be an American. To have freedom means to go and fight wars in Africa, right? I don't know. Why not? If TV says so, it makes sense. And, you know, if the North Koreans can make a bunch of money selling arms to the Ethiopians right at the time where half of our policy says that's exactly what we don't want the North Koreans doing, oh, well. That's okay. The North Koreans can make money selling weapons and prop up their regime a little bit longer as we can. Of course, it's America that's enforcing all the embargoes and rules and trade restrictions on the North Koreans in the first place. And so it's perfectly okay. We can decide to waive those rules as long as they're arming our friends, fighting our proxy wars in Africa. I'm sure I am proud to be an American. If you're real quiet and you close your eyes, you can almost hear the sounds of the hysterical screams of people who are, you know, at this very moment, you know, finding their son ripped in half in the middle of the street in that country because of the United States. You can almost hear them from here. That's pretty far away. Seems kind of strange that America should have to be fighting wars all over the world that are so far away that you can't even hear the people screaming from there. And it seems like they couldn't possibly be our business if they're that far away from us. I mean, geez, if a war broke out between Texas and Louisiana, would we have African peacekeepers come here? Or would it be none of their damn business? Oh, okay, yeah, that's pretty easy, right? When you turn it around, it's just as simple as pie. Yeah, the number is 646-6446, 646-6446, 512-646-6446 if you're from out of town. And, you know, I guess what I could do is play another song. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos 95.9 in Austin. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And that was Road Rage off of old compilation Miss Shauna gave me. Somebody tried to call in, but I think I accidentally hung up on him or something, man. Sorry about that. Whoever you are, go ahead and call back if you want. 646-6446. It's 646-6446. 512-646-6446 if you're from out of town. And, yeah, I got more New York Times here. The Army is cracking down on deserters. Army prosecution of desertion and other unauthorized absences has risen sharply in the last 4 years, resulting in thousands more negative discharges and prison time for both junior soldiers and combat-tested veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Army records show. The increased prosecutions are meant to serve as a deterrent to a growing number of soldiers who are ambivalent about heading or heading back to Iraq and may be looking for a way out, several Army lawyers said in interviews. Using courts martials for these violations before 2002, which before 2002 were treated mostly as unpunished nuisances, is a sign that active duty forces are being stretched to their limits, military lawyers and mental health experts said. Quote, they are scraping to get people to go back, and people are worn out, said Thomas Greiger, a senior Navy psychiatrist. Though there are no current studies to show how combat stress affects desertion rates, Dr. Greiger cited several examples of soldiers absconding or refusing to return to Iraq because of psychiatric reasons brought on by wartime deployments. At an Army base in Alaska last year, for example, quote, there was one guy who literally chopped off his trigger finger with an axe to prevent his deployment, Dr. Greiger said in an interview. The Army prosecuted desertion far less often in the late 1990s, when desertions were more frequent than it does now, when there are comparatively fewer. From 2002 through 2006, the average annual rate of Army prosecutions of desertion tripled compared with the five-year period from 1997 to 2001, to roughly 6% of deserters from 2%, Army data shows. Between these 2 5-year spans, one pre-war and one during wartime, prosecutions for similar crimes like absence without leave or failing to appear for unit missions have more than doubled to an average of 390 per year from an average of 180 per year, Army data shows. In total, the Army since 2002 has court-martialed twice as many soldiers for desertion and other unauthorized absences as it did on average each year between 1997 and 2001. Deserters are soldiers who leave a post or fail to show up for an assignment with the intent to stay away. Soldiers considered absent without leave, or AWOL, which presumes they plan to return, are classified as deserters and dropped from a unit's roles after 30 days. Most soldiers who return from unauthorized absences are punished and discharged. Few return to regular duty. Officers said the crackdown reflected an awareness by top Army and Defense Department officials that desertions, which occurred among more than 1% of the active duty force in 2000 for the first time since the post-Vietnam era, were in a sustained upswing again after ebbing in 2003, the first year of the Iraq War. At the same time, the increase highlights a cycle long known to Army researchers. As the demand for soldiers increases during a war, desertions rise, and the Army tends to lower enlistment standards, recruiting more people with questionable backgrounds who are far more likely to become deserters. In the 2006 fiscal year, 3,196 soldiers deserted, the Army said, a figure that has been climbing since the 2004 fiscal year, when 2,357 soldiers absconded. In the first quarter of the current fiscal year, which began October 1st, 871 soldiers deserted, a rate that, if it stays on pace, would produce 3,484 desertions for the fiscal year, an 8% increase over 2006. The Army said the desertion rate was within historical norms, that the surge in prosecutions, which are at the discretion of unit commanders, was not a surprise given the impact that absent soldiers can have during wartime. The nation is at war, and the Army treats the offense of desertion more seriously, Major Ann D. Edgecombe, an Army spokeswoman, said. The Army's leadership will take whatever measures they believe are appropriate if they see a continued upward trend in desertion in order to maintain the health of the force. Army studies and interviews also suggest a link between the rising rate of desertions and the expanding use of moral waivers to recruit people with poor academic records and low-level criminal convictions. At least 1 in 10 deserters surveyed after returning to the Army from 2002 through mid-2004 required a waiver to enter the service, a report by the Army Research Institute found. We're enlisting more dropouts, people with more law violations, lower test scores, more moral issues, said a senior non-commissioned officer involved in Army personnel and recruiting. We're really scraping the bottom of the barrel trying to get people to join. Army officials agreed to discuss the issue on the condition they not be quoted by name. The officer said the Army National Guard last week authorized 34 states and Guam to enlist the low-ranking group of eligible recruits, those who scored between 16 and 30 on the Armed Services Aptitude Test. Federal law bars recruits who scored lower than 16 from enlisting. Desertions, while a chronic problem for the Army, are nowhere near as common as they were at the height of the Vietnam War. From 68 to 71, for instance, about 5% of enlisted men deserted. But the rate of desertion today, after 4 years of fighting two ground wars, is, quote, being taken much more seriously because we are losing so many soldiers out of the Army that there was a recognized need to attack the problem from a different way, said an Army criminal defense lawyer. In interviews, the lawyer and two other Army lawyers each traced the spike in prosecutions to a policy change at the beginning of 2002 that required commanders to welcome back soldiers who deserted or went AWOL. Before that, most deserters, who were often young, undistinguished soldiers who have fallen out of favor with their sergeants, were given administrative separations and sent home with other than honorable discharges. The new policy, ordered by the Secretary of the Army, effectively eliminated the incentive among squad sergeants to urge returning AWOL soldiers to stay away for at least 30 days, when they would be classified as deserters under the old rules and dropped from the rolls. But some unit commanders, wary of scrutiny from their supervisors, go out of their way to improperly keep deserted soldiers on their rosters and on the Army's payroll, two officers said in interviews. To counter that, the Army adopted a new policy in January 2005, requiring commanders to formally report absent soldiers within 48 hours. Such problems are costly. From October 2000 to February 2002, the Army improperly paid more than $6.6 million to 7,544 soldiers who had deserted or were otherwise absent, according to a July 2006 report by the Government Accountability Office. They mean the Government Accounting Office? This is the New York Times, so you can't expect them to get too many of their facts right. Most deserters list dissatisfaction with Army life or family problems as primary reasons for their absence, and most go AWOL in the United States. But since 2003, 109 soldiers have been convicted of going AWOL or deserting war zones in Iraq or Afghanistan, usually during their scheduled two-week leaves in the United States. With the Iraq War in its fifth year, a new subset of deserters emerging. Military doctors and lawyers said, accomplished soldiers who abscond reluctantly as a result of severe emotional trauma from their battle experiences. James, a 26-year-old paratrooper twice deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, went AWOL in July after being reassigned to Fort Bliss, Texas, an Army post in the mountainous high desert region near El Paso. Quote, the places I was in Iraq and Afghanistan look exactly like Fort Bliss, said James, who agreed to talk about his case on the condition that his last name not be printed. It starts messing with your head. I'm really back there. In December, he and another deserter, Ronnie, 28, who also asked that his last name not be used, tried to surrender to the authorities at Fort Bliss. A staff sergeant told them not to bother, James said. James and Ronnie, who both have 5 years of service, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and abuse alcohol to self-medicate, said Dr. David M. Walker, a former Air Force psychiatrist who has examined both men. With help from lawyers, James and Ronnie returned to Fort Bliss on Tuesday. They were charged with desertion and faced courts-martial and possibly a few months in a military brig. If I could stay in the military, get help, that's what I want, said Ronnie, who completed an 18-month combat tour in Kirkuk, Iraq, with the 25th Infantry Division in 2004. The Army said combat-related stress had not caused many soldiers to desert. Major Edgecombe, the spokeswoman, said more than 80% of the past year's deserters had been soldiers for less than 3 years and could not have been deployed more than once. Morton G. Ender, a sociologist at the United States Military Academy at West Point, said soldiers' decisions to go AWOL or desert might come in response to a family crisis, a threat by a spouse to leave if they deploy again, for instance, or a child custody battle. It's not just that they don't want to be in the war zone anymore, Dr. Ender said. We saw that a lot during Vietnam, and we see that a lot in the military now. So this guy, trying to get himself convicted, the sergeant told him, man, just go ahead and go. We don't want to arrest you. But now he's trying to get convicted in the hopes that somehow he can get some mental health care. Good luck with that, Ronnie. We've talked about that on this show many times. They'll tell you, oh, you don't have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the 8 syllables and a hyphen jargon euphemism, thanks George Carlin, for shell shock. But they'll say, no, what you have is a personality disorder, so therefore you're not qualified to receive any benefits from us. Or they'll say, ah, oh, come on, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are you, a pansy? Drink a beer. Suck it up. Be a tough guy. Yeah, Ronnie, you'll do your time in your brig, but good luck with that, getting that mental health care from the government that sent you to kill people and screw your mind up. Because they don't care about you anymore, dude. They're done caring about you. So anyway, that was from the New York Times today. Desertions up. And Army cracking down on deserters from the U.S. Army. And really, they should be considering themselves lucky that so few have left. A mere few thousand a year. If only it was more than that. You know, there's a way to end this war. For all the soldiers in Iraq to say, dude, I'm not fighting unless it's on the way to the Kuwait border so I can get on a plane and get the hell out of here. War's over. We're not fighting anymore. That would end the war real quick, but I guess that would be too much to ask for the soldiers over there to follow the example of Kevin Benderman and some of the rest of these guys who have refused to take part in this aggressive war any longer. But yeah. Anyway, I guess I'll give out the number one more time. There was one guy at least was trying to get on the air, but I don't know what happened to him. But anyway, the number is 646-6446-646-6446. And, if you're from out of town, put a 512 in front of that. 512-646-6446. I'd be happy to take y'all's calls. But you know me, I still have, plenty of news to, read and comment upon here. Something that's going to be a common theme on this show, you can probably already tell, is what a fascist Rudolph Giuliani is, and how he does not deserve to be trusted with the power inherent in the presidency, or even the usurped power that isn't really inherent in the presidency. This guy Giuliani is an absolute disaster. And not just because his wife murders puppies, which she does. That's not rhetoric or propaganda. You can Google it yourself. His wife is a puppy murderer. But this guy Giuliani is, this guy's really dangerous, I think, folks. So this is, from Saturday, April 7th, 2007. And I think I, have Steve C. to thank for this link. Charleston, South Carolina, as Rudolph Giuliani introduced himself to primary voters this week, he rarely talked about the details of New York's darkest day. But September 11th was a constant backdrop, and as Mr. Giuliani promoted his vision of a forceful foreign policy that calls for the United States to continue slugging it out in Iraq, he let his audiences know that his was an outlook forged by fire. Quote, when they say in Washington, what they say in Washington is not going to affect the fact that there are terrorists around the world that are planning to come here and kill us, he said in Iowa. In the most spirited part of his newly honed stump speech. Yes, they're going to come here to Iowa and kill us, Giuliani says. Rudy Giuliani's biography is clearly his message, especially when it comes to foreign policy. He's drawing heavily on his resume as a crime-fighting mayor who has seen the horror of terrorism to convince voters that he is a candidate who can lead the country in a time of war. Mr. Giuliani struck other central themes as well this week on a 4-day campaign swing that ended in South Carolina on Tuesday. The nation must find a way to become energy independent, he said. Oh boy, talk about proving his ignorance right there. Promising as president to undertake an effort comparable to the one that put a man on the moon. He said he believed there was a broad agreement that human behavior was a factor contributing to climate change. Well, there you have it then. We need the government to take bazillions of dollars out of the private economy and spend it on a new moon mission, to come up with magical sources of free energy. Okay. and let's see. But it was the Iraq War and efforts against terrorism on which he was most impassioned. Until this week, Mr. Giuliani's views on Iraq were not well known, but on this trip he made clear, though never mentioning President Bush by name, that he firmly supported the administration's current strategy, including Mr. Bush's decision to send more than 20,000 additional combat troops there. In an interview, Mr. Giuliani did say there had been mistakes in the execution of the war, including what he described as a failure to send enough troops initially, and the decision to dismantle the Iraqi army that had served Saddam Hussein. Well, of course, that's just a joke. Anybody who knows anything about what happened there in Iraq knows that it wasn't just Douglas Fife and Paul Bremer who decided to destroy the Iraqi army. It was the Supreme Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani who demanded it. The Shiite majority, the Iran-backed factions that America has now put in power, they demanded that the Ba'athist army be dissolved, and America had no choice but to do what they said. Now, I don't know if Rudolph Giuliani is just too ignorant or, you know, if he's, you know, just trying to make himself look popular by repeating this refrain that that was a bad decision. Well, invading was the bad decision, jerk. They had to disband the Iraqi army or they'd have had to start the war all over again against the Shiites in the south who had basically sat by and let them invade. But the criticism ended there. Back to the New York Times here. Giuliani says nation at war requires him. But the criticism ended there. At a House party in New Hampshire on Monday, he said the United States would most likely be fighting in Iraq for a long time unless there is some kind of miracle. He attacked the dangerous and irresponsible Democratic effort for withdrawal timetable. And speaking at a high school in St. Petersburg, Florida, he maintained that the struggle would be over only, quote, when they stop planning to come here and kill us. The crowd loved it. Go get 'em, Rudy, one man shouted. Mr. Giuliani spoke of what else he means when he says America needs to be on the offensive against terrorism. He would resist efforts to water down central provisions of the USA Patriot Act. He favors legal but aggressive wiretapping. He backs intense interrogation of suspects, though not torture. On other policy details, he is less certain. Would he maintain the Bush administration's approach to detention of terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay? He said he did not know enough about it to render a judgment. Well, that's false. New York Times, you suck. I just read Friday the article from the Washington Post where he said he didn't know enough to render a judgment, but then went on to say that, yes, he thought he could indeed kidnap Americans and hold them indefinitely. Well, shit, hang on a second. I got it right here. I'll find it. I'll find it for you, you sons of bitches. Where'd you go, Giuliani? Okay. Well, I can't find it, but it was in the Post last Friday or last Thursday. That, yes, Giuliani does assert the power to kidnap Americans and hold them indefinitely. Okay, here we go. There is a Greek maxim. This is a quote from Rudolph Giuliani. Moderation is the answer to everything, and any extreme is bad. I haven't been to Guantanamo. I can't judge Guantanamo. Yeah, anyway. What are his qualifications for dealing with foreign policy matters? He cited his experience as a mayor of an international city and recalled that he had once kicked Yasser Arafat out of a United Nations celebration at Lincoln Center on the grounds that he was a terrorist. And since leaving office 5 years ago, Mr. Giuliani said, he has made 90 trips to more than 40 countries. In the last few years, quote, I have probably been to more foreign lands than any other candidate for president, he said. At a House party in New Hampshire, Mr. Giuliani suggested that it was unclear which was farther along, Iran or North Korea, in the development of a nuclear weapons program. What? It's unclear? Oh, jeez. Hang on. I got to mark that down to... son of a. As for Iran, Mr. Giuliani said that in the long term, it might be more dangerous than Iraq. Then he casually lumped Iran with Al-Qaeda. Well, for the New York Times to object to that, I guess, is surprising. Their movement has already displayed more aggressive tendencies by coming here and killing us. There you go. Giuliani accuses Iran of the September 11th attacks. Mr. Giuliani was asked in an interview to clarify that, in so much as Iran had no connection to the September 11th attacks. Further, most of its people are Shiites, whereas Al-Qaeda is an organization of radical Sunnis. They have a similar objective, he replied, in their anger at the modern world. In other words, he said, they hate America. Yeah, that's right. Vote Giuliani, already accusing Iran of perpetrating the attacks of September 11th, even though Iran is the next enemy on Osama bin Laden's list to have America, you know, take out of his list of enemies he wants America to take out for him. There you go, Rudolph Giuliani, mixing ignorance with warmongering like only the best Republicans can. I'm really impressed by this guy, Giuliani. What a great guy. You know, why didn't I think of that? Accusing Iran of September 11th. There's your casus belli. Yeah, we all know the Iranians met with Mohammed Atta in Prague, Czechoslovakia, right? Hey, why not? I mean, as long as we're making shit up. Rudy. And do you guys really want a president that has the same name as Huxtable, the Huxtable's little daughter on the Cosby Show? How's that going to play, you know, in the world? For American dignity. That our president has the same name as the cute little girl from the Cosby Show. This guy Giuliani, man, he's a liar. That's what he is he's a liar. And if you want another example of that, just look at his 9/11 record. And just look at the fact that he, along with Christy Whitman and the liars in the federal government, told the people of New York it was safe to go back to work and breathe the air in southern Manhattan, and it was a lie, and he knew it was a lie. It was a lie, and he knew it was a lie. As he told people that it was perfectly safe to go back into southern Manhattan and breathe the air. And, of course, people are sick. Very sick. So, you know, there's this one thing that he's supposedly such a hero about. I wonder, is it not his fault that the firefighters couldn't hear the police in their helicopter saying, oh my God, the top of this thing is twisting. This building's fixing to come down. Get everybody out. Is that not Giuliani's fault that the cops could hear that message and ran, but the firefighters couldn't and stayed longer? Does Rudolph Giuliani really want to bring up his record on September 11th? Putting the emergency command center for New York's response at the World Trade Center complex, which had already been a terrorist target? And then lying to the people of New York, lying to their face and telling them it's okay to come down and breathe the air that was still full of asbestos and mercury and God knows what sort of poisons? Oh no, he's a hero. He's a hero who is the doting and loving husband to a woman who murders puppy dogs. Vote Giuliani, American fascist. Hi, Shauna.
Hey, Scott. Hey, you know, you shouldn't say that Giuliani's not concerned with the health of New Yorkers. Didn't he save New York from the low-fat yogurt crisis on Seinfeld?
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten all about that.
Yeah, come on now. No, I wanted to bring up the idea of these people in Iowa that are sitting there breathlessly sucking it up as he tells them that they're in danger. And you know what you're seeing is that there's this natural human tendency to want to glob on to any kind of a dramatic episode. You know how most people, I guess, are basically bored, and anytime something happens, they've got to rake it over and over, and if they can find a way to involve themselves, so much the better. I mean, look at all the people who were in Austin. I saw the news reporter in Austin talk about how, oh, she was just so frightened and she didn't feel safe anymore the day after 9/11 happened all the way up in New York, a couple thousand miles away. You know, it's just, and it was just ridiculous. Of course, you know, there was this one attack and it was all over. And did she feel safe before? You know, I mean, like, nobody's really safe anywhere. But And these politicians, this is how they manage to garner power through these things. So they tell people that they're in danger too, and they're involved, and it makes them all excited, and they can feel all frightened, and it's even better than a horror picture.
Right, and of course, there's basically nobody saying, "Hey, you're really not in danger. Get over it."
Yeah, well, and you don't want to say you're totally not in danger, because there's obviously these folks out here that hate us that have the capability of actually of striking at any time, because the thing about terrorism is there really is no way to 100% prevent it.
Of course. Any idiot can take a gun to the mall.
Well, or they talk about this guy that's in prison now, Padilla is the way he pronounces his name. And ultimately, they decided to accuse him, I think, of a plot to blow up the natural gas supply to buildings. Well, I got news for you. There doesn't need to be a plot for that.
Sure.
You know, you basically just put out the pilot light, you know,
yeah,
and start the fire in another part of the room and walk out, and it's a done deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, hell, I live right next door to the Quickie Mart, and every couple of days or so, there's an 18-wheeler full of gasoline. You know, I suppose if an Al-Qaeda guy wanted to put the gun to the head of a truck driver and take his truck and crash it into something and cause some civilian deaths, it could be done. And you're right, there is no amount of security that's going to cause that. But, you know, in reality, if anybody in America is safe, it's most likely, you know, people in Iowa. of the people who are the least target, they're the ones. I mean, you and I, in Austin, Texas, there's, you know, at least something of like symbolism maybe to bombing Austin, Texas, the heart of Texas where George Bush is supposedly from, even though our audience entirely including every single one of them knows that he's from Connecticut. But anyway, I could see Austin as some sort of symbolic target for terrorists or something, but Iowa? I don't know.
Well, of course, Iowa is one of our breadbasket states. If there were to be massive damage to, transportation to and from Iowa, you know, it could cause kind of a food shortage and stuff. So yeah. I guess, you know, all states have play their part in our society, and I guess a case could be made that Al-Qaeda could attack anywhere. But really, if you look at the people in Iowa, you're also looking at the people who are the most bored.
Yeah.
Right? People in Austin and New York, hey, we're, you know, busy running around to whatever shows and all the various activities that we have at our disposal. And people in Iowa sitting out on the farm, they pretty much got the TV and their personal dramas with each other and whatever drama the politicians can give to them.
Yeah, it's like an episode of 24 and they get to be an extra in it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, which just, you know, this is the narcissism of our culture that, you know, I guess from a business perspective, nobody in media wanted to come out and say, hey, don't be scared. Your chance of getting killed by a terrorist are less than your chances of getting hit by lightning five times in the same place to death, man. For, you know, you personally, your chances of, you know, having your life ended this way are basically less than nothing. Don't be frightened. There's no money in that. You know, that's not titillating. I hardly feel like an extra in an episode of 24 at all.
Right. And, you know, the other thing is I forgot which comedian it was that was talking about how everybody, oh, Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Bush were such great leaders on the day of 9/11. Well, what did they think they were going to do? Go off and sit in the corner and cry like little children? You know, neither one of them did anything special. All they did was not fall apart.
Sure, and I would actually argue that George Bush did fall apart. He sat there like an idiot till somebody told him it was time to get up to leave. Then he fled in cowardly terror to Louisiana. Then he fled in even more cowardly terror to Nebraska. Didn't return to the nation's capital until that night. Gave three or four completely botched speeches, during the day. Two or three of them, anyway. And I guess a few days later, he did his little stunt with the bullhorn on top of the fire truck and said that the people who are responsible for this are going to hear all of us soon, which, of course, was a lie. The people responsible, besides the ones who themselves died in the attack, are still free. Freer than you and I. Freer than you and me. Sorry, Mom, bad grammar. Bin Laden and Zawahiri still walk the earth and go wherever they like.
Well, I don't know if they go wherever they like exactly, but they are not captured, not killed. And meanwhile, how many of our people, we've already spent more lives in Afghanistan and Iraq than we lost on 9/11 in pursuit of everybody except the actual perpetrators.
Yeah, absolutely right. So, yeah, I mean, and again, with Giuliani handled himself so well that day, honestly, Shauna, I'm at a loss. The only thing I can think of about Giuliani from that day is that when the policemen in their helicopter radioed in that the top of the building was twisting and swaying and they thought the building was going to collapse and that all the cops had to get the hell out of there, that the reason that the firefighters didn't hear that is because of Rudy Giuliani's failure. And that's why those firefighters died. It's all
his fault. Scott, why don't you go ahead and clarify that failure? Isn't that failure to have budgeted the proper amount of money to get a good radio system for all of our, for all the emergency people in New York? Was that how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, how hard can it be to have, you know, channel 1, channel 2, channel 3, channel 4 on your CB radio, and in a circumstance like this where we need to all be sharing the same radio, everybody to channel 4? You don't need, you know, 2007 technology to make that happen. You know what I mean? We're talking about, you know, what, 1950-something, 1960-something technology at the least.
And if there is a city that deserves to have 2007 technology for its emergency system, surely it would have been New York, or in that case, year 2000.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And what did he do? He failed. And that's why he's everybody's hero. It's a contest between the hero Rudy Giuliani and the rock star Barack Obama. And yet I can't find a single redeeming quality from any of these people. Sorry.
Yeah, that's just fine. You know, I don't see the appeal of Barack Obama either, other than somehow or another in our political correctness, we're supposed to believe that because he's black, he's going to be more compassionate and better than these other guys, or because he's latte-colored or whatever.
Yeah, well, I'm not buying it. I don't know how anybody else is, but apparently it is being bought. Thanks for calling in, Sean. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye, Scott.
All right, that was my good friend Shauna K., the Beer Princess. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and gee whiz, we're almost out of time. We could probably take one or two more calls real quick-like if anybody wants to call in 646-6446 or 512 if you're out of town, 512-646-6446. And gee whiz, I saw in the local news last night a story about a guy who has been to Iraq at least once, maybe it was twice, and is fixing to have to go back. And they were interviewing his wife, and she was saying, well, I support him, and I support the mission, because, you know, if this is what it takes to give those people a democracy, then I support it. And I just thought, this poor thing, you know, if at any time in her life she ever figures it out, how heartbroken is she going to be if she never gets her husband back? She's already, you know, seen him sent over there twice and been lucky enough to get him back. And now this is what she has to tell herself, that her husband's job is giving people a democracy in Iraq. Ah, oh, jeez. You know, that's not what the war's about. And the thing is, you could find out the truth yourself. I guess if you know, you're a woman with a husband over there fighting, you might not want to know the truth, because you're going to have to face the fact that your husband is risking his life for things that you wouldn't approve of him risking his life for. But you can go back to 1991 and read Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby's defense planning guidance. You can read the Project for a New American Century's report entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses. You could read William Crystal and Robert Kagan writing in Foreign Affairs toward a neo-Reaganite foreign policy. You can read A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, which was a policy paper written by Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and Was it Fife Pearl? It wasn't Wolfowitz. Oh, Fife Pearl and David Wormser, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor. Their study, A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, which was advice to Netanyahu that what he needs to do is wage preemptive wars against Syria and Iran. And the first step will be focusing on regime change in Iraq. You can read all these things. You could go to Mother Jones and read The Lie Factory by Robert Dreyfus and Jason Vest, or Dreyfus's great article for The Nation, Agents of Influence. You could read Julian Borger in The Guardian and his article, The Spies Who Pushed Us Into War, or The Spies Who Pushed for War. I'm sorry, Julian Borger. There's one by Jim Loeb on antiwar.com called Pentagon Home Office to Neocon Network. Seymour Hersh has at least two articles that are specifically on the neocon cabal who lied us into war and why. Selective Intelligence and the Stovepipe, both of those for the New Yorker magazine. Karen Katowski, of course, was an an Air Force lieutenant colonel who retired as soon as possible after the war and came out and told the whole story of how she saw her boss, Bill Luddy, who is a member of the Office of Special Plans, in conjunction with Douglas Fife and Paul Wolfowitz, Michael Rubin, Abram Shulsky, did I already say Shulsky, Elliot Abrams, and the rest of these guys lie us into war from the policy department under Douglas Fife at the Pentagon. And she told that story in a three-part series for the American Conservative magazine in Rumsfeld's shop. What was the second one called? I forget. And then the third one is Open Door Policy. She also wrote an article for Salon.com called The New Pentagon Papers that explains who these guys were and how they lied us into war. And, of course, at antiwar.com, if you were to just search antiwar.com for Office of Special Plans, you could learn all about it. I just finished printing out last night the Inspector General's report that was we talked about back in February. The entire thing has been released now by one of the Democratic members of the Imperial Senate, I believe Carl Levin. So I'm going to try to read through that and highlight any of the interesting parts to cover with you guys later in the week. But, yeah, your husband's not over there to give them democracy. That's not what this war is about, giving people democracy. And I think it's basically unforgivable that not just the American government, but the American media have let these kinds of lies stand for 4 years now. 4 years since the fall of Saddam's statue. 4 years since the beginning of the weekend interview show on Radio Chaos. My first guest, Alan Bach. 4 years later, and it is unforgivable that the media has let those kinds of frankly, pathetic and ridiculous lies remain in the minds of Americans who are, frankly, sacrificing their family members over this. They deserve to know what this war is about for real. If nobody else does, at least the wives of the guys who are going over there to die deserve the truth about why this is happening. But maybe that's a bridge too far. And speaking of Alan Bach, one last thing, my friends. Alan Bach has a great article called Lamenting Lack of War. It's up on antiwar.com. It was, I guess it ran Friday, but it's still there in the right-hand margin of contributors. And it's about the war party, particularly some of the guys over at the National Review and so forth, lamenting the fact that the British worked out a peace deal or worked out a peaceful arrangement with the British for the release of their captured sailors and Marines, and Alan Bach castigating them, taking them out to the woodshed for being disappointed that there's not going to be a war against Iran, at least not yet. So please check that out, Lamenting the Lack of War. And yeah, that's it for Anti-War Radio for April the 9th. 2007. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, hopefully with more good interviews news, and phone calls for you. This is Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM, 92.7 FM in Austin, Texas, streaming live worldwide, KAOS 959.com.